SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour two, and I couldn't help but start the part of the show with Carol Cedeno and the seven wins yesterday at Delaware. And, of course, Tony Black has a distinction of having had that kind of a day. And, in fact, his day famously extended from afternoon session into an evening session, and he'll tell you about that. But the best part of this Carol Cedeno achievement is, dating all the way back to Eldon Nelson, Tony rode against every single jock that's been involved in this story. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, I was really excited to hear about Carol Cedeno's seven-win day. I know she had to be tremendously excited. I mean, jocks just don't do that in one card. They just don't do that. And I think the best I did at Delaware, I had a five-win day, and I thought that was a thrilling one-card day. But I rode against Eldon Nelson. He retired. He came back to riding. When he came back to riding, he rode a few more years. I think he had a cattle ranch in the West or something that he was owned and managed. But when he came back to riding, he happened to have some of the best later years of his career when he won for Del Carroll, the Preakness, on BBB. I mean, some of the riders I rode with were just great examples of horsemen and jockey and skillful individuals. Eldon Nelson, Bill Passmore was riding in Maryland at the time. Bill Hardtack was still kicking him around there. Joe Colmone was riding. I mean, names from the past, and I'm thinking, you know, you didn't think a lot of it at the time, but when you look back on it, man, I was fortunate enough to ride with some really great old riders.
Well, we're going to have you talk about Carol in a second, but here's the list, Tony, of riders who had won six that she surpassed. Eldon Nelson, 1958. George Cusimano, 1968, he did it. Greg McCarron, 74. Jimmy Edwards, 84. Mike McCarthy did it twice, 97 and 98. And Joe Rocco Jr. in 2011. And then Carol yesterday. But you rode against those other six guys.
I rode against every one of them. You know, like you say, Eldon Nelson, right up the list, Jimmy Edwards and Joe Rocco being the youngest of all the ones on that list. It's amazing when you think about having a six-win day. I mean, like I said, the best I ever had was a five-win day a couple times at different racetracks. But seven, I mean, that's just amazing. It's amazing for her to have a seven-win day. And were they seven consecutive, or did she ride something in between?
She got stopped a couple of times in terms of a streak, but seven total.
That's something, because I would have to call her today if it was seven consecutive and tell her, listen, the next two you ride will tie, maybe could be a record that you could tie, and that would put you at nine consecutive, and be smarter than me. You can break that nine consecutive with ten consecutive if you really use your head, but she didn't get them consecutively, so I don't have to call her. But I see her over here at Parks on occasion. She gets on horses for Juan Vasquez and some other people, and she's certainly deserving of the recognition of having seven wins. She's deserving the recognition of just being a good, good, good rider. And I always hate to use that term, oh, a good female rider. That's all right. BS. Let me tell you something. These girls, they compete because some of them have a little different style than the men riders, you know, and they use a little different techniques, but they are as accomplished as any man rider could ever hope or think or want to be. So I never use the term, oh, she's on the top of the list of the girl riders. she's on top of the list of riders, general, just period, riders. She's a good, good rider.
You know, and she, what's amazing as part of this, I mean, she's young. She's 27, I think it said, 28 in one of the articles. She's been a, she's been riding feels like 10 years, and she had the broken vertebrae from an incident at Penn National, came back from that. She's been off twice to have children, and has won 3 riding titles, and those that watch the Mid-Atlantic racing, Philadelphia, Monmouth, Delaware, Colonial will be back next year. She's been very steady. I mean, she's going to ultimately, right now, she's got 700 and change wins, but you know, she'll win as for as long as she wants to ride.
She'll hit that 1,000 mark in within the next less than 2 years. But she's an accomplished mommy and an accomplished jockey. I got to give her a lot of credit. My hat's off to her. And you know what? She's like just every other jockey that's out there. You get hurt, and the first thing that comes to mind isn't, oh, I hope this doesn't happen again, or when's this going to happen again? It's, man, how long is it going to take to get over this? How long is it going to take? You know, the doctors tell you it's 6 months, and usually you're back in 3. They tell you 6 to 8 weeks, and you're back in 3 to 4 weeks. But that's what jockey mentality is. The ones that really are accomplished and that survive and that persevere, they have that mentality of, not is it going to happen again? You know, am I going to break some more vertebrae, or am I going to break this arm again? It's, man, how long is it going to take to get over this little setback? That's the mentality of the jockeys that last in this business.
Now, when guys and gals get into these rhythms, Tony, my partner Barry, we were at Saratoga, and I remember John Velasquez, I think, won with his first 3 mounts, and Barry said, "Who's, you know, next race was coming up?" And Barry said, "Who's Johnny on here?" And I, you know, whoever it was, and I said, "I don't know if this horse is worth betting." And he says, "Don't." He said, "Don't worry about that." He said, "When riders start to get into these skeins, you don't bet against them. Just keep betting them." And he was right. And I think Johnny might have won. He won either 5 or 6 that day. And of course, there was a day. I've got a great picture of Ramon Dominguez the day he won 6 up here. It's just a weird phenomenon. And you look at the, you know, in some cases there's going to be horses that were favorites or, you know, made sense. But then when this starts to happen, it feels like the rider is just elevating some of the winners, because not every one is an obvious favorite.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's the power of positive thinking. And that's also the other thing I hit on when it comes to riders that are in one of these modes: confidence. Winners build confidence, and confidence goes a long way in any business. But in the horse racing business, sometimes you get into these, you know, these mindsets and these rhythms, and you wonder, are these horses, are they reading me, or am I reading them? You know, who's the smartest one here? Is it the horse, or is it jock, or is it truly a combination of two great athletes on a trip of positive thinking? Positive, confident thinking. You know, I can tell you that story I've told a zillion times, and I got to tell it. You know, I got to brag a little bit. I rode it up 9 consecutive at 2 tracks in 2 days. The first horse I rode was for E.T. Garcia at Keystone, right? Or not Keystone, Park. Philadelphia Park. I got beat a nose on that horse. The next 2 horses I rode at Philadelphia Park that day won. I went to Atlantic City that night I went to Atlantic City. I rode 3. All 3 of those horses won. That put me at 5. The next day there was no racing at Philadelphia Park, so I just rode at Atlantic City that night. I was on 4 horses that night. The first one won, the second one won, and then I get a call after the second one won, which made it 7 consecutive. I get a call from the announcer, Letterman, Larry Letterman. He says, "Hey, Tom." He says, "You know, 7 consecutive winners is pretty, you know, good." He says, "I think you're coming up on something if you can win the next one or the next one." And he wasn't sure at the time, but he said, "I think it's something, you know." So I won the next one. I get a call back in the chat room. He says, "Listen, Tone," he says, "9 consecutive, that's 8 consecutive you just wrote. 9 consecutive is a record that was set in 2 days, I think it was, at Marlboro Racetrack by a jockey named, I think his last name was Richards. And that was in 1931. He says, "If you win this next one, you tie his record." I says, "No kidding." I says, "Oh, we've got to go out there and see what we can do." I go out there. I come to the eighth pole. Looks like I'm going to win it. And a horse come past me. Steve Kapanis was on a horse. He went past me, got a head on me. And I just drove this son of a gun as hard as I could, like I thought I drove every horse. And I got back past him, and I won my 9th consecutive race in a 2-day period, and it was a record. It was in 1998, I think, because it was in the 1998 Guinness World Book of Records. It said it tied a record from 1931. But it was really a cool feeling, and then it convinced me, you know, there is something to positive thinking and confidence in any business, but let's not eliminate it and think it's not an important part of the horse racing business. And it makes you think to yourself, you know what? I better go out there, whether he's 20-1, 2-1, or 200-1. You know, as long as he's trying under me, I better go out there with the idea I can do it. You know, like the little choo-choo train going up the hill. I think I can. I think I can. Well, you go out there as a jockey and you say, "You know, I know I can. I've done it before. Let's see if we can make this horse know he can." And you go out there with that attitude, a lot better attitude than going out there and saying, "Well, I got to ride this 50-1 shot. Jesus Christ, what'd my agent do to me?" You know, it's a lot better way of going out there thinking, "Let me be positive. Let me try as hard as I can try. Give everybody the best shot I can possibly put on a performance out there."
You know, what's unique about it in the discussion, as opposed to a team sport athlete that may have, you know, individual opportunity moments, whether it doesn't matter, a basketball player gets hot and drains everything, golfers, etc., you know, tennis player, when baseball, they're focused in, hitters, and, you know, guys hit 4 home runs in a game, and, you know, some of those outlandish, you know, hitting for the cycle, whatever it might be. The difference here is you're partnered up with the horse, and the way in which a dialed-in jock elevates a horse is literally the confidence that you're translating. Typically, Tony, I would guess with the knees, right? With the way you're pressing against them as you ride, and because the hands, you know, you're handling. I suppose you got the hands on the neck a little bit, so there is some hand contact, but it's a phenomena to see a rider that somehow is able to transfer their air of confidence into the horse. And it's happening. I mean, it's not, we're not making this up.
No, it's definitely the contact that you have with the horse between your legs, your body weight, you know, plays a big part of it. The weight of your body and the way you position it over top of that horse. You're never sitting on him. You're over top of him. And, of course, your hands and the way you use the bit and the way they respond to the bit and how far up his neck you take a hold, how far back down his neck you take a hold. It gives them an air of confidence when you're helping them feel comfortable You know, some horses carry their heads lower, some horses higher, some horses you can get on their mouths a little more than other horses, but you're totally adjusting to what makes that horse feel as comfortable as possible. You know, sometimes you get a horse, they call them heavy-headed horses. They carry their head a little lower than their withers, you know, and they actually look like they're putting their head down. Well, sometimes you can ride those horses a little longer, you know, and they're not pulling you forward and over top. Your legs are riding up against their sides and making more contact with their legs. You can sink that bit in their mouth pretty hard, and it balances them. You know, it's like a seesaw balance, you know. Their head's down, their ass is up, their head's lower than their ass, and you're kind of helping pick it up and put it in a more comfortable position. It's called a heavy-headed horse. Well, how do you ride them? You ride them longer. If you ride them too short, they're pulling you down. If you ride them longer, you're behind their mouth. And that's why I tell these kids how to position themselves on the way the horse goes. The way that horse moves, and I'm not saying every horse is different, but there are different types. And the way that horse moves, it's very important for you to become in unison and synchronized with that horse's motion, his action, to where he's feeling comfortable. You know, some horses you're using the bit more. Some horses, hey, listen, you can make a horse switch leads just by swaying them like you would riding a bicycle. You don't have to turn the handlebars to go left or right. You throw your weight left or right, and that moves the bicycle. Well, sometimes these four-legged bicycles you're on move the same way. If you utilize that technique, you know, use your weight. Use your legs to keep yourself in a very firm purchase where you're not bouncing all over their back, swaying from side to side. Your purchase on a horse's back really, really does play into his being able to maximize himself in a way that you're not throwing him off. You're in unison with him. And it's so very important. You have to be in unison with that horse's motion, with the horse's way of going. You have to be balanced with your weight over his back, his mouth, his hind end. It all fits. It's like a well-oiled machine if you're doing it all right and you're adjusting to that horse.
And I'm glad you mentioned the heavy-headed type. And I'm going to assume that when we're watching those horses and, you know, observing their style, is that kind of what I refer to as the anteater, the one that keeps their nose kind of pointed down at the ground?
Right, absolutely. And if a rider doesn't learn, and I learned, and I had old riders, I'll never forget an old man that rode that took me under his wing at Liberty Bell in 1970, Chris Rogers. And, you know, he watched me ride this heavy-headed horse. And I'm a kid starting out, and I'm riding short like all the riders looking pretty want to do. They want to ride short. You know, you wonder what they even have webbings on their irons for. They should just attach their irons to their saddle. He said, hey, son. And he'd go, hey, kid. He always used to call me kid. Hey, kid, you want to get comfortable on a horse like that and not feel like he's pulling you over his head and into the ground? Drop them irons down. Stop trying to look like a pretty jockey and start looking like one that knows how to ride. And he says, you understand what I'm saying, kid? And he'd have a cigarette in his mouth. You know, he quit drinking at the time. Have that cigarette in his mouth and he'd be in the jock's room. It was a different air, you know? Jocks went in the hot box, came out of the hot box after they sipped on some blue blackberry brandy or vodka, and they had a cigarette and a rub down. You know, the masseur would rub them down and they'd have a smoke. Well, they don't do that no more. But I'll never forget old Chris Rogers when he told me, drop them irons down, stop trying to look pretty and start looking like a jockey that knows how to ride. And they were just great teachers, those old guys. You know, I think he was, his claim to fame to me was he rode, I think, a horse called Lincoln Road and finished second in the Kentucky Derby, Chris Rogers. And I never forgot him. He took me under his wing for 3 months at Liberty Bell, and he made some differences in my style of ride. But heavy-headed horses, you're right, they're like anteaters. Their nose is all but rubbing the ground. And if you don't ride them long, you can't get behind their head. You're over top of it. You ride them long, and your feet are in a position and your legs are in a position where you can get that bit in their mouth. You can help them and balance them, and you actually could keep that bit in their mouth where you actually keep their head in a position where their stride is being used efficiently and effectively.
And we've had these conversations, Tony, when you've explained the this part of the balance, but you've never actually laid it out in this fashion. I'm glad this came up and went in the direction that it did.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because when you look at a horse race, you say, you know, so many people have the idea, oh, that horse, he's doing all the work. You're just sitting there. Number one, you're never sitting on their back, number one. And number two, yeah, that horse is doing his job, and you're working just as hard to help him perform his job and utilize his energy efficiently, utilize his stride efficiently and effectively. You know, you're helping him. And you're actually, to help a horse, you better be physically fit. And you better have, you know, good respiratory. You better have good muscle fitness and stamina. And you better be able to last as long as that horse can last. Not just to control him, to steer him left or right, but to balance yourself on his back in a way that, I can't say it enough, and I'm saying it one more time. Balance yourself on his back where he can utilize his energy and his stride efficiently and effectively.
Well, and you also, since you brought up Chris Rogers and Lincoln Road, that would have been 58 behind Tim Tam, and then he was second in the Preakness too.
God, you know what? I forgot about that. Yeah, these guys were great teachers, and if they, you know, sometimes the only reason they took you under their wing was because you happen to have the same ballot, and that's what. Him and I had the same ballot at Liberty Bell, and he saw me ride some races. He saw me do some stupid things. I'll never forget one day he saw me run up a horse's ass. I don't know how the horse didn't fall, except their legs didn't get tangled. My horse's head was on the other horse's ass in front of me, and I backed him out of there without hitting heels. He says, "Hey, kid." And you know, I'll never forget the way he said, "Hey, kid," was so neat, with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He says, "You're going to hit the ground. You do that too many more times." He says, "You got lucky." He says, "You want to do it? You want to hit the ground? Don't do it while I'm behind you, because I don't feel like running you over, kid."
I love
it. These guys were some teachers. Guys like that were amazing. You know, it's almost a shame we don't have them on film, because they would be a movie in themselves, because they were unique individuals with personalities of every type. You know, you had guys like Phil Grimm, Paul Kaly. You know, Phil Grimm, at times you thought, does this guy like anybody? Yet he would take you under his wing and he'd like you. Paul Kaly, you think, well, is he a rider or is he a boxer? Because he can box, you know, and strong as a bull. You know, you say, man, I don't want to get into it with him. That sounds, they just got muscles on top of muscles, fit as a fiddle. He'd kill somebody. Yeah, and I was just so lucky to have contact with these guys. It brings back so many good memories. You know, Eldon Nelson, Bill Passmore, guys that we mentioned. You know, it's amazing. I was so lucky. You know, guys like, is that Joe Colnell? Of course, Patterson. We used to call him Pity Pat. He brought his, he had a parody brought to the jocks room and kept it on the pipes over top of the locker room. And he taught this parrot to say some, I can't say, well, he said something about the stewards. he taught him to say something. And don't you know this parrot started to say it while the stewards, after the movies, walked into the room, and they had this parrot using the F word to the stewards. And I mean, man, God, you're gonna get ruled off. You're gonna try to ruin me off. It's the effing parrot saying it ain't me.
That's great.
Lord Patterson brought his parrot to the Jackson, who were keeping there, you know, during the races, and the parrot had some choice words to say about to the stewards that the steward happened to hear, and it was lucky. I think it was Mr. Hudson or what? I don't know. Mr. Dangerfield, one of them, Palmer, Dangerfield, Hudson. These are all names from the past, and they looked and they saw it was a parrot, and they lucky they had a sense of humor.
Yeah, that's a rare commodity, frankly, when it comes to the to the stews. Pretty funny.
It is at times, and rightfully so at times. We're always put in a position of judgment. But in fact, you look at our game, you know, when it comes to the officiating end of our game, it's moved kind of slower, hasn't changed, as other sports have changed the officiating way of their game, you know, like baseball and football and different sports like that. I don't know if it's because they're trying to catch up to us, or we're getting left behind. But our game, the officiating part of it, is basically the same as what it was you know, over the years.
Well, Tony, as always, we never know where we end up with these conversations, but I knew that throwing out those names that you wrote against, that Carol Cedeno bypassed in the record book yesterday, I knew that would provoke a fun visit. So, as always, I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always fun to reminisce and take that short walk down memory lane. It makes me appreciate where I am today and how I got here. And I always say that first horse I rode, Stand By Me, that was something more than just a horse's name, because it took a lot of people and a lot of guys like those jocks you mentioned to stand by me, to teach me, you know, to get me to this point where I can say I was fortunate enough to walk away in one piece. But it's always a pleasure to take that little trip down memory lane. I know I gotta let you go, Steve. You take care, keep up the good work, and thanks for the little bit of reminiscing today.
Always great. And Tony Black, folks, next week we'll catch up and be right in between Saratoga and Del Mar, and can't help but smile when you listen to Tony, and he pulls out the history that he's lived, and the insights, and you know, it's funny how he gets me into the reaching for the American Racing Manual so often, and in particular here, Lincoln Road. I mean, there's there's a nice horse who had a very good 3-year-old year, and I'm a big Tim Tam fan, so you know, he mentions Lincoln Road, and you know, you see Lincoln Road behind Tim Tam in both the Derby and the Preakness. So it's a name that, you know, that you remember, even though he doesn't have a huge presence historically, although he certainly had a nice enough career. But it's just one of those, you know, sort of obscurities. That's great. And Chris Rogers, the jock, second in the Derby and Preakness behind Tim Tam. Let's take the timeout, bottom of the hour. Morning's flying by, as always. And Steve Haskin. We'll talk to Steve, get his impressions of the 3-year-old action in particular. And, of course, we looked ahead to the Stars and Stripes card with Steve last Thursday. And Steve was right out in front of Athena. He said that is too accomplished a filly to just dismiss, and that would have been a good piece of advice to pay attention to. I certainly didn't. Steve Haskin, we come back second half at the races.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Fun in the Sun is ExpressBet Summer Treasure. If you can't make it to the spa or where the surf meets the turf, do the next best thing and play Saratoga and Del Mar with ExpressBet. And while you're at it, don't miss ExpressBet's $100,000 Fun in the Sun handicapping competition. Play Saturdays by making a live $10 win wager on one horse in each of 10 competition races. Each week, top players collect $4,000 for first, $2,000 for second, and $1,000 for third. Plus, based on cumulative earnings throughout the season, the top four finishers will win Pegasus World Cup Handicapping Championship seats, a $12,000 value each. Pre-registration is now open for account holders only. Don't miss this fantastic opportunity to shoot for some cool fun in the sun Saturday summer cash with ExpressBet Saratoga and Del Mar. Visit ExpressBet.com now to open an account and for complete fun in the sun details.
Account wagering is not permitted in all states. National Problem Gambling Support Line, 1-800-522-4700.
Pennsylvania's breeding program is truly the most lucrative in North America. Now, we'll pay a 50% breeder award for PA-sired, PA-bred maidens who run first, second, or third, with 25% for non-PA-sired, PA-breds. Last year, the number of mares bred rose by 15% in Pennsylvania. And unlike some other states, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support Pennsylvania breeding and racing. This is Brian Sanfratello. Please visit us at PABred.com.
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.
Hi, John Pirana here, inviting you to join me in the Dublin Racing Club, along with friends like Steve Bick and Tom Durkin. If you have an interest in Ireland and horse racing, it's the best way to be involved with both. So log on now to DublinRacingClub.com and come join us at one of Ireland's 26 racetracks.
The Dublin Racing Club is designed to introduce racing fans to the ownership experience by participating in the sport in Ireland. For more information on the Dublin Racing Club, log on to DublinRacingClub.com.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.
You've got an open heart, so you share what's inside, thinking that all is said in confidence. But then you realize the sun is here.
We're back at the races, about 25 minutes to the top of the hour, and, you know, waiting for Steve Haskin, who I'm sure will join us momentarily, and I went to look at the chart. As I said, I pulled out the American Racing Manual, and here's Steve Haskin, and I'm going to throw this knuckleball at Steve, and he'll probably, you know, double off the wall with it. Steve, I don't know if you were listening for Tony Black just now, but he inadvertently brought up rider Chris Rogers. The motivation was what happened yesterday with Carol Cedeno winning 7 at Delaware. And the prompting of Rogers brought up Lincoln Road, who was second in 58 to Tim Tam in both the Derby and Preakness. And so I knew Lincoln Road's name, but I wasn't sure who trained. And so I looked it up, and it's Vic Savinsky, who in his career started two horses in the Derby. Lincoln Road, second, and Venetian Way, who won. What do you know about Vic Savinsky?
I know absolutely nothing. I know more about him now than I did before you mentioned what you just said. I've heard of Lincoln Road. Obviously, I heard of Fluffy Debonair, but Vic Savinsky.
Vic Savinsky. Yep. He started two horses in the Derby.
Where did he come from, and where did he go?
Well, well, I'm going to find out. This is one of those apocryphal circumstances. You know, I've wanted to do a series, and you could help me. About horses that time forgot, and that were really good, and that for whatever reason just don't get the attention that they deserve by comparison to, you know, some horses that, you know, just have lived on in history. But
well, I tell you who nobody remembers. Nobody remembers Kentucky Derby runners up.
There you go. I've got book ideas, and that happens to be one of them, called Best Seat in the House. The riders who finished behind, you know, their view of the Derby, finishing behind the Derby winner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can go through a whole list of, I remember, you know, when I first got interested in racing, you know, when Damascus was the big favorite in the Derby and Proud Clarion won. The horse that finished second was Barb's Delight. I mean, nobody has a clue who Barb's Delight is. And I think a perfect example of that, I tell you, Lincoln Road, you know who he always reminded me of? Jamie Kay. Jamie Kay, who got beaten photos in two Triple Crown races by Native Dancer.
Hmm.
And Lincoln Road, by the way, also finished second in the Preakness. So, I mean, you know, he just came along in the wrong year because Lincoln Road, I mean, Tim Tam definitely would have been, I shouldn't say definitely, but most likely would have been a Triple Crown winner if he didn't fracture his leg at the quarter pole of the Belmont Stakes. Now, granted, the horse that beat him was, you know, was a European horse named Cavan, who was a natural stayer and who won off by himself. But, you know, nobody knows what would have happened if Tim Tam hadn't fractured a leg and never raced again. But he still finished second. And everybody knows that he did it at the quarter pole. But, you know, you think of Tim Tam, and you think of, oh, yeah, he got beat by Cavan in the Belmont Stakes, but nobody remembers Lincoln Road. And, you know, it's not like he demolished him in the Derby and the Preakness. I mean, Lincoln Road ran great races in both of those races.
Tim Tam only caught Lincoln Road in the last couple of jumps. He was looking to be a wire-to-wire winner.
Well, listen, Lincoln Road was a good horse going into the Derby. I think he was second in the Florida Derby in one of those big races.
Yep, and it won. He had won. I don't know if he had won. Not was it the Bahamas or one of those. He had taken the Hialeah Gulfstream route. On the way.
Yeah, I mean, he lost a lot more than he won. He didn't win very
yes,
many races, if I remember
right.
correctly. Yeah, he didn't have the best of record, but he had a good in-the-money record. I mean, he just got good around, you know, in that winter of 58.
He did win.
Tim Tam was one of the earliest horses I ever remembered, because I remember first time I heard his name, I was in school. So this would have been, let's say, 58. So I would have been 11, so I was probably in like the 7th grade or something like that. And I remember being in class, and I remember the teacher talking about Tim Tam. And I remember saying, why would they name a horse after a cracker? Because, you know, unless you're really Jewish or so, but Manischewitz, and they still do, actually. They're still on
sure
the show.
Sure they do.
Yeah, but Manischewitz made a cracker called Tam Tam crackers.
Right.
And I'm saying Tim Tam. You know, I kept thinking of the cracker because we used to buy it. My mother used to buy Tam Tam crackers all the time. So that was my first recollection of Tim Tam. Because, you know, it's a cute name. I mean, it's a good
yeah.
name. It's just, I always think whenever I think of Tim Tam, I think of Tam Tam. And the amazing thing is, if you go to a supermarket now, they still sell Tam Tams.
And the other aside is, of course, the Australian baker that named his cookie after Tim Tam. that's become an international cookie, you know, stalwart. Sure. that's on the shelves. So today you can go to Gristiti's and get Tim Tams and Tam Tams.
Yes, I don't know if Gristiti's would sell Tam Tams, and I don't know if ShopRite would sell Tim Tams. I mean, you might have to go to Gristiti's for the first one, and you may have to go to ShopRite or Acme for the second one.
It's just fun to
whatever's around you.
It's just fun to say Gristiti's. That's what.
Yes. Well, yeah. It's fun if you got the money to afford it. Let's put it that way. It is quite an interesting store.
We had a really fun.
You never know where a horse is going to show up in a conversation.
Well, exactly, and that's what's great about the game. And I'll tell you another funny thing. I don't know if you saw, if you've been doing any Twittering yet this morning, but I circulated a piece that Vance Hansen wrote at Briss, and it's at the Twin Spires blog role as well. But didn't we talk about Mongo a few weeks ago?
It's possible. We talk about so many horses. In what context?
I forget how Mongo came up, but he did. And it most typically in a conversation, the place for Mongo to come up. Actually, you know what? Mongo might have come up with Sid.
Yeah, I don't recall the.
All right, you would have. You'd recall if we had. So it must have been with Sid Fernando. But anyway, it just so happens that
another horse that most people nowadays never heard of, who was you know, a household name back running against Kelso and
exactly
Gunbo, and I mean those were great crops of older horses.
Well, Vance Hansen wrote a terrific piece, and I termed it genteel. He wrote about Montpelier and Marion Dupont Scott and the wonderful facility, the former James Madison homestead that you know, now is a basically a national historic preservation site, Ingleside Training Center. Woodbury Payne and Olga, they train horses at the barn. They've got turf gallops. They've got a wood chip track. They go up and down all different kinds of turf gallops, and terrific facility. You can get Virginia certified 6 months before a horse turns three, and you're eligible for 25% bonus. Anywhere you're running in the Northeast. But Vance wrote a really nice piece about Mongo and Montpelier that I know you'd enjoy. And it was just funny.
I'd love to read about that.
Yeah, I'll send you the link.
I mean, Mongo was one of the early horses. Obviously, Roundtable was the one who became the first, you know, great, and I use the word great literally, grass and dirt horse. I mean, back in those days, you had very few grass horses, but you had some. If you were a grass horse, you weren't a dirt horse. Roundtable was both, and right after him came Mongo. I mean, Mongo beat Kelso in the DC International. He won the UN a couple of times. He won a whole bunch of stakes on the grass, and he won a whole bunch of stakes on the dirt major races. I mean, he won all kinds of these major handicaps. I mean, he was always right there, you know, back in the early 60s, you know, at the height of Kelso and Gunbo and Mongo. And it was great, great racing back then.
What's interesting, Steve, when you look at this, and I've got Mongo's record in front of me, he was 22 for 46. And despite, you know, the impression of his turf prowess, only ran on the grass 8 times in 46 starts. But yet, you know, like you say, that was an era where there were some great turf stakes, but they were secondary. I mean, we're in the most pronounced era of turf racing in American thoroughbred history.
For sure, you know, especially with the Belmont Derby now. But like you said, the two biggest races were the UN and the Washington D.C. International. And you know, around that time is when the Man of War, which was a fairly new race that, you know, NYRA came up with, was starting to gain in popularity, and you started getting good grass horses. But you know, for a long time, the biggest grass races in the country were the UN running this in the usually in September, and then the Washington D.C. International, which like I said, which Mongo, when Kelso won the Washington, D.C. International, it secured Horse of the Year because he beat Gunvo. It's one of the best horses ran in it. I mean, Damascus, after his long campaign, wound up running in the D.C. International and got beat in a nose by Fort Marcy. I mean, River Ridge ran in it. He never should have, but he ran in it. We always had our greatest horses ran in the D.C. International. But Kelso got beat four times in the race before he won it. And one of the horses that beat him was Mongo. Maybe he got beat three times. It was either three or four.
You know, I'm looking through this.
I remember a European horse, Max the Second, beat him one year. I think TV Lark might have, but
TV Lark had won the year before, I think, right?
Yeah,
wasn't TV Lark the defending? Was he the defending?
I think he beat Kip, but I think he was one of the horses that beat Kelso.
It could be.
I think. I know Kelso got beat by Mongo. He got beat by Match the Second. And I think he got beat by TV Lark.
There was also, you mentioned the Man of War. And I didn't realize until seeing it in Mongo's PPs, the Knickerbocker, which was run in October.
Yeah.
30,000.
Yeah, and Knickerbocker was a good race. There weren't, like I said, there weren't a lot of
big grass races
back then.
Yep.
The only ones that still exist, I think they used to run the Lexington back then. That was a handicap race.
Yes.
The UN. There was a prep for the UN called the Kelly Olympic. That was actually a pretty good race for a prep race.
He won that. He won it by, in fact, before he won the UN, he beat Bronze Babu by a nose in the Kelly Olympic. And then he won the UN over Never Bend and Carryback.
I had another horse right in that era for the older horses, of course, and Carryback was in that era. Carryback, he had retired to stud. They brought him back from a stallion, and he came back, and he was still a top handicap horse. I think Carryback, if I'm mistaken, but I think Carryback ran like 23 times as a 2-year-old. I think Carryback, by the way, Carryback, not only that, by the way, but Carryback started his career as a 2-year-old in January. I think he ran about a dozen races before he got up to 6 furlongs.
That's funny.
He was running at 2-furlong races, 3-furlongs, 4-furlongs, 5-furlongs. He was a grizzled veteran by the time he got up to 6 furlongs.
There it is. He debuted on January 29th, 1960.
Yeah,
Hialeah. 3 furlongs. He had run 5 times by April.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, how many times, go to his first 6-furlong race. How many times did he run before he ran 6 furlongs? I'll bet you it was almost a dozen.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 times before he ran 3/4 in the sapling.
Is that a man? Okay, you got to love it. Jack Price, I mean, you talk about one of the great great characters. There's a photograph that was given, which I actually gave to Avi and Rhoda. I thought they would get a kick out of it. It was a great photo. I figured they could put it to... I don't have any really photos up on my wall or anything. I thought they could put it to good use. But it was a black and white shot of Jack Price sitting outside of Carryback's stall. And Jack Price is reading the forwards. As you can see, all the Hebrew writing on there. He's reading the forwards, and he's giving Carryback a box of matzah. And that, by the way, I tell you another thing, by the way, if you can ever find it, if you ever want to read the most entertaining writing ever, go back to the Daily Racing Form, or Morning Telegraph, I should say, archives, and go back, I think it was in 62, I believe it was, go back to when Carryback ran in the Arc de Triomphe. Sol Rosen, who was the editor of the Morning Telegraph and Daily Racing Form, he was very close with Jack and Catherine Price. And he and when he sent Carryback to the Arc, Sol assigned Jack to write a column every day leading up to the race. It is hysterical. Talking about Carryback's the help that he had there, the exercise rider and the grooms going out every night to the Bois de Boulogne looking for the hookers. What was the jockey? I think was it Scobie Breasley? I think it was.
It was Breasley. Absolutely was Breasley.
Yeah, okay. Well, Scobie Breasley, but they couldn't stand Carryback. And they couldn't get permission to work him out over the track. Jack wanted to work him out over the track. And he had all these problems with Scobie Breasley, because Scobie Breasley didn't think he was much of a horse and had no shot to win the race. But Jack Price, he told it like it is. I mean, he was a real, real character, real character. And his columns, by the way, from the Arc, from Paris, were so incredibly entertaining and funny. And about his whole experience there. And this was at a time when I think the only American horse that ever shipped out there was when C.B. Whitney sent out Career Boy and Fisherman to run in the Arc in the 50s. Unfortunately, he picked the year to run in there, the same year as Rebo. So it wasn't a very good year. And then Raymond Guest sent out Tom Rolfe to run in the Arc in 65. Unfortunately, that was the year of Seabird. So the American horses did not pick the best of years to run in the Arc. But I think, and the thing, it carried back, I think, finished like 10th or something that race.
He was 10th.
Like four lengths.
Five and three quarters.
Like that.
Yep.
What's that?
Five and three quarters.
Five and three quarters. He only got beat five and three quarter lengths in the race.
He took money, too. He went off what? At 11 to 2.
Really? Wow, I didn't realize it was that short.
And he carried 132 pounds.
Yeah, well, that's all the older horses, all the older horses. And weight for age back then, all the older horses carried, 132. But if you ever get a chance, anybody get the archives, from the old Morning Telegraph and read Jack Price's columns leading up into the Arc. I used to have it. I was obviously when I was in the library, I had all those columns. I should have made copies of them. But they were absolutely hysterical. You talk about somebody who told it like it is and shot from the hip. He didn't pull any punches, Jack Price.
He bred Carryback.
What's that?
He bred Carryback.
Oh yeah. It's incredible. I mean, look at the pedigree on that horse. It was by Saggy out of Joppy. I mean, nobody ever heard of either one of them. I mean, you talk about Rags to Riches story. And then to be running as a 2-year-old in January. it's unheard of. And he became a national hero. And I remember I was a kid. And everybody was talking about, I remember we were playing wiffle ball up against the garage out in the street on 64th Street in Brooklyn. And people were talking about Carryback. And I remember people saying, wow, he comes from so far out of it, and he saves his run to the end. And he comes flying late at the end of the races, and he became such an exciting horse. And I distinctly remember saying, well, that makes so much sense. Why doesn't everybody do that? Why doesn't every horse run that way? I mean, it just made perfect sense. You save your best running for the end. I didn't know anything about racing, but he was a talking. I remember going into Molly's Luncheonette on Sunday morning, and buying the Daily News, and I remember the headline, the back of the Daily News, which says Carryback beaten, and and he gets beat by a $100 horse named Sherlock that nobody really even know anything about. But everybody was in a state of shock. How can a horse who runs like him, who saves everything for the end, how can he get beat? Not only get beat, he didn't even run well at all. He didn't do anything in the race. But, yeah, everybody was conceding him the Triple Crown. People don't realize what a big name he was during that Triple Crown. I tell you who had great stories to tell, by the way, was Tommy Kelly.
Well, Globemaster. He ran against Globemaster a bunch of times.
Well, what happened is that Globemaster and Carryback were in the same barn, you know, in the Preakness.
Tommy's told this story. He told this story on the air with me. This is an amazing story. Sure. Famous.
Yeah,
about
the great story. When
the moldy hay.
Yeah, Carryback was he had all this moldy hay that he would have gotten deathly ill from it had he eaten it. And Tommy went in and took all that hay out and brought the good hay in for Carryback to eat. And Carryback nailed Globemaster right in the last few strides.
In the Preakness.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tommy told that story. He told that story on air with me in one of those two great conversations.
For the Blood Horse, I remember when I was in Florida, I went to his house.
Miami Gardens.
Miami Gardens. I went to his house. He had a house right on the golf course, mm-hmm. and he told stories. Oh God, the greatest stories! Just some of the most amazing, amazing stories. He was a great storyteller, but he told me that story.
And you know, here's another. It's amazing. We hit on today two horses. And Carryback and Lincoln Road, and you know, these are every one of these it would make a book, and you know, you could have so much fun when you look at who he banged heads with. Carryback, Beau Prince and Crozier, there's a horse that nobody, you know, Crozier was a hard knocker,
second to him in the Derby.
Yeah, never got his due, really. Globemaster faces off, and then they all became older horses, you know, running in all the great handicap races, the New Orleans Handicap, the Gray Lag, the Met, the Suburban. Speaking of which, let's segue. What did you think of Saturday? It certainly was an eventful few hours at Belmont, I'll tell you that. I had a great day.
Well, I tell you, I mean, with every race, I get to love Catholic Boy more and more. I mean, I was big on him, you know, as a Derby horse. I loved him. I just loved him in a Remsen. And I loved him. I fell in love with him in the paddock before the Remsen. He just had this beautiful head, this beautiful chiseled look. He had the look of a real class horse. And, you know, to come off the grass like that for the first time and just blow the field away in the Remsen, I just loved everything about him. And I remember when I thought he ran an excellent race at Tampa. I mean, I thought it was a very good race in the Sam Davis. And then when he came back in the Florida Derby, it was a big disappointment until you found out that he bled. And he bled really badly in the race. So now he comes back on turf. And these last two races, by the way, you just don't see that. I mean, in the Pennine Ridge, I mean, I don't know how he came back in that one. That was like Buck Passer coming back against Apes Hope in the Chicken Flamingo. I mean, how he came back from there. You know, it's not like he just battled back after getting headed. I mean, he battled back after analyzing, was pulling away from him. I opened up like a length on him, and he came back. And then he wound up, looked like he was dead. It looked like analyzed and had him in this race, too. And he just battled back. I mean, you just don't see that. And now the thing is, you say to yourself, well, what do you do? Sure, you know, you can go to the Secretariat, but, you know, with Justify out of the picture, and we don't know what the three-year-old situation looks like now. I mean, there's still a big lure to bring him back and put him back on the dirt again. I mean, he's going to love a mile and a quarter. If you point him, give him a shot for the Travers. If it doesn't work out, then you can always put him back on and, you know, point him for the Turf Classic or or any of the big turf races that are left at the end of the year. But I don't know. I wouldn't discount putting him back on the dirt again. I mean, you got a chance to win the Travers. You know, Secretary, it's fine. But I don't know. That's a pretty enticing lure to bring that horse back and put him on the air. Because, you know, we saw what happened last year with Good Samaritan. They brought him back. They brought him back one race too early. If they had waited and put him back in the Travers, he might have had him. You know, he might have had a much better shot. I don't know if he would have beaten West Coast, but he would have had a much better shot of winning that race. But you know, first time back on the dirt, I just knew he was going to run a monster race, and he did. Unfortunately, he was in the Jim Dandy, and a lot of times, you know, you come back and then it's hard to come back the second time to do it again. But the big explosion that was in him was for his first start off the grass. And if they had waited, you know, if they had waited until the Travers, might have been a different story. But I don't know. I could see this horse being very, very live for the Travers, going a mile and a quarter. I don't know. I don't know what's going to be around there. We'll see what happens. You know, we got some. We had the Iowa Derby last year. We got the Indiana Derby and the Los Al Derby this week. So we'll see what comes out of there. Another horse I would be an eye on, King Zachary. I'm curious to see how he does, how he handles this field in the Indiana Derby. And then you got, you know, the Los Al Derby through a small field, but yeah, there's some, you know, pretty nice horses in there. We'll find out how good that draft day is.
Back to New York for a second, Steve, and then we'll want you to
not
talk
draft
about
day, draft pick.
Draft pick, yeah. Peter Ertin. I made mention that, you know, you warned that Athena was too classy to just gloss over, and yet we 10-1 basically. Yeah.
Oh my God, $22 on Aiden O'Brien with Philly with all that form coming in. I mean, having run, you're talking about a classic Philly. It was narrowly beaten in the classic. But I mean, how about that? By the way, listen. First of all, in this country now, it's unheard of to run a horse back in 17 days. Here's a filly who runs three times in 17 days in three different countries. I mean, you know, but, you know, our horses are running out. They need 5 and 6 weeks between races. This is a three-year-old filly. Three grade one stakes in 17 days in three different countries. And the third one is when she wins and looks fresh as a daisy in there. And Aiden O'Brien has never been afraid to do that. Listen, how many times has Aiden O'Brien run the Breeders' Cup coming off the Champion Stakes and the Queen Elizabeth Stakes coming back in 2 weeks? And his horses run well. So, I mean, he does it all the time. And listen, I hate to keep going back to the past again, but it was routine. All the races back then were run. They were scheduled 2 weeks apart. You know, running the Triple Crown was not a big deal for those horses. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, all the races. You know, everybody's talking about Damascus. You know, when he ran into Gotham and he got beat by Dr. Fager into Gotham. And then he wound up winning the Wood Memorial by 6 lengths. The Wood Memorial was 1 week after the Gotham. 1 week. I mean, can you imagine that now? I mean, that would be totally insane to have two prep races run a week apart. Damascus come off a hard race in the Gotham. We battled Dr. Fager the length of the stretch, and comes back 1 week later and wins the Wood Memorial. But you know, listen, it was a different mindset. I'm not saying horses can't do it now; they're just not given an opportunity. Maybe they can't. I don't know. Maybe maybe the hay, oats, and water back then had more to do with it, and you didn't have all the, you know, Lasix and Bute and all the medication in there. But I don't know. All I know is that, you know, back then it was routine. Look how many horses, Elliott Burks, look how many times Elliott Burks ran in the Met Mile between the Preakness and the Belmont, with horses that had run in the Derby and Preakness. And all three horses that he ran the Met Mile won the Belmont. I mean, Bold Ruler, by the way, Bold Ruler in the Derby. After he ran in the Derby, you know, if people say, oh yeah, Bold Ruler ran in the Derby and then won the Preakness Stakes. They don't realize he won the Preakness Prep. The Saturday in between the Derby and the Preakness. You know, it was done back then. Citation did it by, you know, running in the Jersey Derby in between the Preakness and the Belmont. It was not a big deal. And now it happened. I keep going back to the Derby itself. If you look at Calumet's Derby winners, you look at Citation, you look at Whirlaway, you look at Pond, you look at all their big Derby horses, by the way. Every one of them ran in the Derby trial 4 days before the Derby.
Sure.
They ran, every one of them ran in the Derby trial on Tuesday. Every one of them worked a half a mile on Thursday, and every one of them won the Derby on Saturday. No big deal. How many years, by the way, how many years was the Bluegrass run 9 days before the Derby? Nobody batted an eye. All the preps, Wood Memorial, Arkansas Derby, we're 2 weeks out. So times have changed. I'm not saying whether it's, you know, good or bad, but we just don't see these horses. That's why I wrote that column last week, by the way, is that nowadays we have to, you know, taking Bob Baffert's three horses in the last 4 years, you put them all together and you got one of the all-time great horses. But individually, the horses just don't run enough. As great as they are, you can, you know, if I may be, as great as American Pharoah may be or Arrogate, they're never going to be considered one of the all-time greats. Yeah, you can call them a great horse if you want.
Sure.
But you're not going to rank them with Man of War and Secretary and Citation and Forego and all those great horses, the all-time greats. Not with the amount of races they run. So, you know, now we need three horses, a three-horse composite to demonstrate all the attributes and all the feats that the that individual horses did years ago. I know I sound like one of these old timers that are going back there, but you know,
I'm sure
a lot of racing fans are going to be frustrated. You know, would justify. Yeah, listen, I would be surprised if he ever ran again. I hope he does. But yeah, to me, it looks like the handwriting's on the wall, and there's going to be another horse that we will never ever find out how good he is. And people forget too. By the way, you go back. Everybody talks about if you look at other Triple Crown winners that are ranked, you know, as in one of the all-time greats, like Seattle Slew and Affirmed. Seattle Slew and Affirmed became ranked as one of the all-time greats, not by winning the Triple Crown, but by what they did as four-year-olds. I mean,
sure.
I think if you look at Seattle Slew and Affirmed, look at their three-year-old campaigns after the Triple Crown, I think they won a total of one race. Seattle Slew got buried, you know, in the Swap Stakes. Affirmed won the Jim Dandy and got beat four times after that as a four-year-old. You know, granted, two of them were Slew, but he went off form at the end of that year, you know, with coughing up, and then he got disqualified in the Travers. But if they had retired at the end of three, do you think they would have been regarded as great as they were? No, look what they did as four-year-olds. As great as Spectacular Bid was at three, he became, you know, people say now that he's one of the greatest horses they've ever seen because of what he did it for. So it's just frustrating that you look at horses like Justify and you look at horses like American Pharoah Arrogate sort of, he's in a category by himself because even though he ran as a four-year-old, he came along so late, missed the Triple Crown, that people really didn't get a grasp of who he was until, you know, until he ran in the Travers. But you start looking at a lot of these horses, you know, Smarty Jones and Fleet Alex and just horses that just, because of injury or whatever, stud fees, whatever it was, they never got a chance to prove how great they were because horses mature as four-year-olds. These horses are still babies. It's like teenagers. It's like trying to say, you know, who's the greatest athletes of all time. I'm putting teenagers in there. These horses are all teenagers. They don't look at California Chrome. He didn't get good until he was five. And when I say good, I mean he didn't reach his peak until he was five. As good as he was when he won the Derby and the Preakness, you know, he wound up running terribly in the Pennsylvania Derby, and he got beat in the he ran well, but he got beat in the Breeders' Cup, and then he had that crazy 4-year-old campaign, and as a 5-year-old, he became a national hero at five. So, I'm just saying that's the shame of it all. The shame of it all is that we're never going to find out how good these horses were. And I don't include Secretariat in that. Secretariat, after the Triple Crown, ran six times after that. Five of them against older horses. And I don't know if you want to use the word excuse or reasons, but two of the there were reasons why he got beat in the Whitney. Obviously, he was sick, and he got beat in the Woodward Stakes, in which he ran an incredible race. But he never should have been in that race in a million years. He was just not ready for it. But, I mean, to run six times after the Triple Crown and run against all the horses in five Grade One stakes? Yeah, so he's in a class. He's in a category by himself. But if Secretariat, you know, if he'd retired after the Belmont Stakes, he would have been legendary. But he wouldn't have had the same kind of record he does now by setting records on the grass and setting world records in the Marlboro Cup. And, I mean, yeah, the things he accomplished after that were amazing.
So, you know, it's tough. It's tough. The economics, Steve. The pressures make it. Yeah, that's a big part of it.
Well, not only that, by the way, but you have to remember that, you know, horses back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, the vast majority of them were homebreds. They didn't worry about stud fees because they retired them to their own farm. They didn't worry about stud fees. You know, back then, I mean, when they started syndicating horses, if you syndicated a horse for $1 million, that was a lot. You know, then went up to two, three, and then, you know, I mean, Secretariat syndication was through the roof. You know, it was almost $2 million more than any other horse that had ever been syndicated. I think Buckfast had the previous record. But yeah, when you had horses, they were retired to the same farm. And they had books of 40 mares, not 300 in two, you know, in two hemispheres. Now there's so much, you know, these horses are so overbred and they travel so much. You know, I was at Windstar a few months ago, by the way. We saw More Than Ready. You guys, More Than Ready made like 23 trips to the Southern Hemisphere. And he's still going strong. Look what he signed. He got a Belmont Derby winner. And he's done unbelievable this year. But he's made 20-something trips to the Southern Hemisphere.
He's the poor man's Scat Daddy.
Yeah. And Scat Daddy, you know, God knows how good he could have been. You know, he just emerged, you know, like a rocket this year.
And that's another pressure that's involved here with Justify is getting him into service to stand up for the absence created by Scat Daddy.
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, I don't know. You would have thought Windstar would retire them, you know, to their own farm, but it's not going to happen. So, I mean, most likely we're going to have two for that price.
No.
The same farm.
Yeah.
But, well, you have all these big breeding farms. They buy into these horses. They buy their breeding rights early in the year, and they sit and wait. They sit and wait, and then, you know, the stipulation is that they retire after the 3-year-old campaign. So it's just so much money floating out there and so much being offered. You know, and then you take into consideration the insurance rates of how much to insure these horses by if, you know, you win the Triple Crown. The premiums on these, you know, on these insurance of these horses, yeah, times have changed. And it's unfortunate. I mean, it's great for the people who make money, but for the racing fan, they, you know, they got to enjoy these horses, you know, in such a short window. Six races, seven races, eight races. You know,
enjoy him we have, so no matter what happens.
What's that?
Well, enjoy him that we have.
That's all you can do. Yeah. What Justify did in those 112 days, it was unprecedented, and you enjoy it. And, you know, of course you're going to get frustrated that when you're never going to find out how good a horse he could have been. We haven't seen Justify anywhere near his peak. Justify would have been forgetting about the end of this year, he would have been a monster next year. But all you have to do is, you know, you accept it and you wait for the next Baffert horse to come along.
Well, that could be. There were people that expected it to be Axeman, he kind of laid a
CP rebounds. He's running in that low sell Derby.
Yes.
You know, and that's not even counting Mastery. A lot of people thought he would have been right up there with these big three horses in ability. And we still got McKenzie.
Yep.
You know, he's still a awfully good horse.
Yep. Well, Steve, we got the whole second act really to play out between now and September, and the next round, Indiana Derby Saturday night, Indiana Oaks. We had a big one thing we didn't talk about on the Philly front, had Kellen Gorder yesterday and the performance from Red Ruby that pretty much stamps her.
Oh yeah,
as a
gotta
serious
add her
player
to the mix now. This three, well, you know, yeah. Everybody was knocking his 3-year-old Philly crop early, and it's getting stronger and stronger.
Yes,
it
is.
You definitely have to add Red Ruby to the mix now. With, I mean, just look at Monomoy Girl and Midnight Bisou, and I mean, it has an awful lot of good 3-year-old fillies. Very talented, and Wonder Godot.
Well, we'll see her Tuesday at Fort Erie.
Yeah. And I would imagine they're gonna, after that, I'd probably go to the Alabama instead of going for the Triple Crown, I would think, right?
Exactly.
Or maybe they can do
that's
both.
What, no, they're not going to do both. Mark was on last Thursday, and as irresistible as a Triple Crown try might be, the Alabama, and frankly, depending on what Monomoy Girl wants to do, it really does potentially set up a pretty fascinating cast coming together when we assemble for the Alabama.
I don't think they're all going to meet until the cotillion because I mean, Monomoy Girl most likely will go in the Oaks and pass the Alabama, and Midnight Beast will pass the Oaks and go in the Alabama. So we'll have to wait for the cotillion for those two to meet, you know, going a mile and eighth, and I think that'll be a great race, and we'll see where Wonder Guitar and Red Ruby fit in by then.
Well, Red Ruby, it certainly has every look of a mile and a quarter filly.
Oh, sure.
And we know Wonder Godot with her exploits in the Queen's Plate and that
Kentucky Oaks.
I mean, you got a really interesting development here. And then let's see what happens with the late on Saturday at Delaware in the Dell Cap.
And I think of a first start going 8.5 months to come back in a mile and a quarter.
I know. I can't remember anybody doing that in recent memory.
That's tough to do. To come back that long to go a mile and a quarter. And the one thing about Delaware is that I don't have to tell you, Delaware is a very quirky, deep racetrack. It's a tiring track. So we'll see how the track is playing, but it's not the strongest field, but there's a few good fillies in there.
Yeah, no, it's a nice enough group. Mopatism. Don't know what to. Are the Redhawks coming east?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Paul or not.
All right. Well, we know you're coming north. That's what counts. We got.
That's the only direction to come.
I love
it. This time of the year, there's only one direction to go in, and that's north, straight up, straight up the thruway and the north way. That's the only way to go.
Now, looking forward to it, Steve, and we'll talk to you next Thursday. It'll be right between Del Mar opening day and Saratoga opening day. A fun, fun visit. I appreciate it.
Okay, Steve. Anytime you want to bring the old fogey out and me, just give a call.
We trot out old Grandpa. He's got his corn cob pipe.
When you start the conversation on about Lincoln Road. You can't.
Where
you
are we going to go?
Good idea where you're going to be heading for
exactly.
The rest of the conversation.
Exactly right. No, it was fun. It was really good. Steve Askin, everybody, always great. Let's take the bottom of the hour timeout coming up toward the bottom. Quigley is got an appointment. He can't join us, so we'll talk to Tom next week for his Del Mar preview. But we owe Rich Eng. We're way behind with Rich Eng visit. So we'll catch up with Rich and more in this last half hour on this Thursday. I'm actually scooping up Tina here at when we wrap up.